Good morning, everyone, and welcome to today's press conference at the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium by UT Health San Antonio Cancer Center, the American Association for Cancer Research, and Baylor College of Medicine. I'm Rachel Salas-Silverman, Director of Public Relations for the AACR. Today, we'll have four presentations with an opportunity to ask questions after each using the center microphone here in the middle. We'll also have reporters joining us by phone, and if you are by phone, please press star 1 to ask a question. Please remember to silence your cell phones and use the microphone when speaking, as the press conference is being recorded. And now it is my pleasure to introduce you to our moderator today, Dr. Virginia Cacomani. Dr. Cacomani is co-director of the SABCS and the leader of the breast cancer program at UT Health San Antonio. Dr. Cacomani.
Thanks, Rachel. I want to thank you all for being here today. I'm told by ACR we have 140 members of the press, so we truly appreciate you all being here and covering the meeting. There's really exciting abstracts, posters that are going to be presented, and four of the ones we have here today. So without further ado, I wanted to introduce Dr. Andrea DeCenci. He's Director of Medical Oncology Unit at the National Hospital in Ospedale Galliera in Genoa, Italy. And he's going to be talking about a randomized placebo-controlled phase 3 trial of low-dose tamoxifen for the prevention of recurrence in women with operated hormone-sensitive breast, ductal, or lobular carcinoma in situ.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everybody, and thank you for the opportunity to present our results at this press conference. So I have no direct financial relationships to disclose. My hospital receives institutional funding both for non-profit and profit clinical trials. So with the introduction of mammographic screening, intraepithelial neoplasia represents at least 20% of all breast neoplasms. This entity includes atypical ductal hyperplasia, ductal and lobular carcinoma in situ. These disorders have a slight different heterogeneous behavior. While ADH and LCAS may be offered tamoxifen based on the results of the NACBP prevention trial with a low uptake, however, there is a tendency in the last few years to de-escalate the treatment of DCIS, which includes radiotherapy plus 5 years of tamoxifen, because of the lack of evidence on overall mortality. We know very well that tamoxifen is very effective in prevention, but its toxicity, namely rare cases of endometrial cancer, deep vein thrombosis, and menopausal symptoms, represent an important barrier for its broad use in the population at increased risk for breast cancer. This drug is quite old. It was developed in the 60s, and at that time, the minimal effective dose was not assessed. This drug binds to the estrogen receptor with a saturation kinetics, but is not clear what is the minimal active dose to elicit its biological and clinical effects. So our hypothesis was that a lower dose, namely 5 milligrams per day, and a shorter duration of treatment, namely 3 years, was as effective and less toxic than 20 milligrams a day. So some 15 years ago, we conducted a randomized window opportunity pre-surgical trial in women waiting for surgery, where we randomized women to 20 or 5 or 1 milligram per day. And you can see here very clearly that the lower doses, even 1 milligram per day, was not inferior to 20 milligram in decreasing breast cancer proliferation as measured by Ki-67, whereas in the control arms there was an increase 4 weeks apart. So the study design of this trial is the following. Women aged 75 years or younger with either ADH or LCIS or ER-positive or unknown DCIS were randomized to 5 milligrams of tamoxifen per day or placebo for 3 years plus at least 2 years of follow-up. The primary endpoint of the trial is the incidence of invasive breast cancer or DCIS. 500 participants were enrolled from 14 centers in Italy. The women were assessed every 6 months with clinical visits and quality of life questionnaires, and mammography was repeated every 12 months. The median follow-up of the current analysis is 5.1 years and is based on a total of 42 primary breast cancer events. These are the main subject and tumor characteristics as a baseline. You see there is no imbalance between the two arms. Mean age was 54. 45% were premenopausal. As you see, the Mediterranean diet works because the mean BMI was 25. 20% had ADH, 10% had LCIS, and 70% had DCIS. Two-thirds were ER positive, one-third was unknown. There was less than 10% of HER2 new overexpressors. Quadrantectomy was performed in more than 80% of the women, and radiotherapy was delivered to the women with high-risk DCIS, namely G3, Comido, positive margins, or younger age. These are the main findings of the trial. There was a 52% reduction in the cumulative risk of developing a recurrence in the low-dose tamoxifen arms, 28 versus 14 events compared with placebo. This difference is statistically significant. The annual risk of events declines from 24 per thousand per year to 12 per thousand per year. Likewise, perhaps more impressively, there was a 75% reduction in the risk of contralateral breast cancer with low-dose tamoxifen, but of course this analysis is based only on 15 events, so we have to be cautious. Serious adverse events, of course, in this de-escalation trial, toxicity is as important as efficacy. We saw one case of stage 1 endometrial cancer on tamoxifen, one case each of deep vein thrombosis, and one case of deep pulmonary emboli in the placebo arm, no difference on other neoplasms, coronary heart disease, one death on tamoxifen, two deaths on placebo. If we compare these findings with the NSCBP-P1 prevention trial with a dose of 20 milligrams per day, we would expect 2.7 endometrial cancers on tamoxifen and 2.4 DVT or pulmonary emboli. So patient-reported outcomes are as important as efficacy. Here, we carefully assessed the frequency and intensity of hot flashes, which is the most frequent side effect of tamoxifen, using a semi-annual questionnaire self-reported by the women using the method developed by Loprinzi and co-workers. There is a slight borderline significant increase in the number of hot flashes per day, less than one hot flash extra on tamoxifen. Whereas if we multiply the frequency by the intensity, there was no significant difference between the two arms. Perhaps more importantly, vaginal dryness or pain during intercourse was not affected by the use of tamoxifen, and likewise, musculoskeletal pain or arthralgia, which are the most important side effects of aromatase inhibitors, were not increased by the tamoxifen. So I want to conclude by saying that we have shown that 5 milligrams per day for 3 years can halve the recurrence of breast intraepithelial neoplasia in line with the effect noted with 20 milligrams per day or even slightly better in the NSABP B24 trial. Low-dose tamoxifen decreased contralateral breast cancer by 75%, suggesting a strong preventive potential. The rate of endometrial cancer and DVT on 5 milligram was not different from placebo and 2 times lower than 20 milligram. The menopausal symptoms were not worsened except for a borderline effect on hot flashes. We think our results have external validity given the pragmatic nature of the trial and the easy accessibility of the drug. and are therefore generalizable. Because the 5 milligram tablets are not available in the market, you can either cut the 10 milligram tablet or use the 10 milligram every other day, which I think is applicable in clinical practice from tomorrow. The study was supported by the government, the Italian Ministry of Health, and two charities, the Italian Association for Cancer Research and the Italian League Against Cancer. We are indebted to these supporters for the continuous support to non-profit trials for fair, equitable, and affordable medicine. Thank you for your attention.
So we'll take some questions now. I'll start with one. So the standard of care, besides the dose being 20 milligrams, is also 5 years. So do you think with this trial we're justified to just give 3 years of tamoxifen instead of five, or in your practice would you go to 5 years?
Well, in my practice, I've been using lower dose for 15 years now, and the duration would be shorter, yes, absolutely. I think the five years intervention is based on adjuvant trials, but this is a different cohort, non-invasive disease. And so, I mean, I would say that, our data supports the use of 3 years.
Go ahead.
Caroline Helwick, ASCO Post. So if your population was about 60% with DCIS, how can your endpoint be DCIS, one of your endpoints?
Well, DCIS is a recognized endpoint in DCIS population because the majority of the recurrences are DCIS as well.
Okay, so it would be more DCIS in a patient who has DCIS, like more lesions?
More recurrences, both in the same breast or the contralateral breast.
Okay. Remember, with DCIS, we excise it, and so it would be in the same breast. You could get
who
it back.
Okay, and these patients had surgery then to have
yes.
the DCIS removed.
Correct.
And then they got it again.
I'm sorry.
Okay, no, that's okay. And then on your outcomes, your all breast events, what does that include?
Invasive breast cancer or DCIS.
Okay, thank you.
Has anyone else studied this? I'm sorry, Nick Mulcahy from Medscape. Has anyone else studied this? Low dose.
Except for, our group, you mean?
Yeah.
There are some groups which are doing trials with low-dose tamoxifen. For instance, there is one trial in this country in the women who had Hodgkin lymphoma and were irradiated. This is a very high-risk cohort for developing breast cancer. They are doing a trial of 5 milligram.
Oh, okay. And again, what's the trial group or the organizers of that?
I don't remember now. I mean, they.
Okay, but this isn't a completely novel concept.
It is. It is quite incomplete. But the drug is generic. The problem of tamoxifen is that it's too cheap, I think. So there is no commercial interest in developing it, both from the industries and the doctors.
It seems like such a great idea. I mean, it's amazing that it hasn't been tried before.
When you look at drug development, in many cases we rush these drugs out and we don't pay attention to the dose that's needed. We pay attention to the dose that's not very toxic. And so many of the drugs that we use, we actually end up using them at higher doses than we need to use them. And this is an example of a drug that's been out for, 50 years. And we've had the, we've thought before that we don't need that full dose. And the benefit of these sort of trials is a drug doesn't work if you don't take it. And so if you can find ways to take the drug, like in giving it at lower doses, then these women are going to benefit. When you look at data on aromatase inhibitors, 60% compliance. That means 40% of the women don't take those drugs.
One last question. In the press materials, you said this is practice changing. Does anyone on the panel want to comment on that? Do you agree with that?
looking at this data, I would certainly give, especially in the ADH and the LCIS patients, I would definitely give lower doses of tamoxifen. The DCIS patients, I mean, you know, this study is based on few events, and obviously there's going to be more follow-up. And once you have more than 42 events, I think, in the DCIS patients, you can apply it. But if I have a DCIS patient who's not tolerating tamoxifen at the 20-milligram dose, I'd be extremely happy to lower it to 5 milligrams based on this data.
Thank you. Charles Bank, Head MedPage Today. A couple of questions related to dosing. The data on Ki-67, it appeared that one milligram might have been even more effective than five. Why did you go with five instead of one? And secondly, why did you choose placebo as opposed to what's considered the standard dose, 20 milligrams?
So the first question, one milligram was as active or not inferior to the other doses, but in other surrogate biomarker trials that we have done, it was less active in modulating circulating biomarkers such as insulin growth factor 1 or lipids. So we chose 5 milligram because it appears to be the compromise between activity and safety. Second question, we could have done a non-inferiority trial compared with 20 milligram, but there are a couple of constraints. The first is a larger trial. We didn't have the resources to do that. And secondly, the women don't want to take 20 milligram.
Dr. Cacciamani, how do these fit with the current practice standards in North America? Is tamoxifen the standard? Do they use AIs for this indication? What are the possible implications?
So AIs in the past few years became one of the treatments for DCIS and high risk lesions. The problem is you can only give it to postmenopausal women, and when you look at the data, it was superior in the women up until the age of 60. And if you think about the fact that they go into menopause probably at 52 or 53, we're really talking about 8 years, right, where AIs are superior to tamoxifen. And again, you're having an issue with compliance as well there. So for the rest of the patient population, tamoxifen is an excellent drug. One of the reasons we try not to use it in older patients is the risks, the risk of DVTs and the risks of endometrial cancer. If you don't have that, I would think that would be a wonderful idea for our older patient population too.
On your baseline characteristics, excuse me, it said ER positive DCIS, but it didn't specify for the LCIS. Were they had to be ER positive, right?
LCIS is virtually ER positive in over 90% of the cases.
Okay.
So we didn't mandate to measure it in LCIS, but some cases were measured, but
okay.
The problem is with the DCIS.
Okay, and also, are these patients continuing on tamoxifen now that the study's over? Because if you stop it, wouldn't their risk recur?
Well, no, the study has finished in terms of the intervention. We are following up the women, but one question is whether there is a rebound effect, which absolutely requires that you don't treat any longer.
Okay. Thank you.
And this will be the last question.
Yeah. Marisa Weiss, breastcancer.org. You know, remember, it originally started when tamoxifen was introduced at 40 milligrams a day. So it went from 40 to 20, now, you know, down to 5, et cetera. So this, we know this medicine so well over so many years. The problem is when you're, you know, talking to patients about it, they've heard too many of the bad stories and not the good stories. And it, for people to be receptive to this, we almost need to reintroduce it as a new medicine with a new name, or not to be anything but fully transparent, but to sort of make a have to distinguish the experience of being on the 5 milligrams a day from the 20 in a thoughtful, accurate way. Otherwise, it's really going to be hard to compel people or intrigue them by the therapeutic benefit. And I would just say it's also, as you were saying, just there's so many women stop an aromatase inhibitor, don't capture its value because of real or perceived side effects, and we need to, you know, rethink about tamoxifen again, and not, it's the unpopular younger sister kind of thing in the series of choices. So,
well, that's
hopefully.
Where we rely on you.
Yes.
When you all are you know covering this to spin it in a way, obviously a true way, but so that we don't frighten our patients.
Right.
Because these are drugs that they won't work if we don't take them, and if they get too frightened and they don't take them, they won't get the benefit from them.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments.
Thank you so much. So we will move on to our second presenter. It's Dr. François Bidard. He's coming from the Institut Curie and the University of Versailles. The abstract is Clinical Utility of Circulating Tumor Cell Count as a Tool to Choose Between First-Line Hormonal Therapy and Chemotherapy for ER-positive, HER2-negative metastatic breast cancer. Results from a Phase 3 strict CTC trial.
Okay. Thank you for this opportunity to present our work. And so this is a very big question, and we had challenging results as well. So the idea is in the context of metastatic breast cancer, that is hormone receptor positive, HER2 negative. I'm sorry, I forgot the conflict of interest. The study has been partially funded by Menarini, which is the provider of the circulating tumor cell count. So in the context of first-line therapy for hormone receptor positive metastatic breast cancer, we know that we can treat this patient with either endocrine therapy or chemotherapy as frontline therapy when they relapse. And since in the 90s, we had trials showing that chemotherapy was not superior to endocrine therapy. And since that time, endocrine therapy is a preferred first line for most patients in the absence of either primary endocrine resistance or serious concern about the patient prognosis. And here's the issue, that the patient prognosis thing is evaluated by clinician, and it's poorly reproducible from one clinician to another, one center to another, and one country to another. And in that context, the CTC count is highly relevant because we know it is a reproducible biomarker that has been FDA cleared for clinical use. It has reached a level of evident once in terms of prognostic biomarker. And we also know that it is superior to all the usual prognostic markers that are taken into account by clinicians to choose between hormone therapy or chemotherapy. So here the aim of the trial was to compare head-to-head a CTC-driven choice between hormone therapy and the clinician choice between hormone therapy and chemotherapy. So main inclusion criteria were hormone receptor positive, HER2 negative metastatic breast cancer without any prior therapy for metastatic breast cancer. They had a condition compatible with hormone therapy or chemotherapy, and they were randomized one by one into the two arms of the study. In the first arm, which is the standard arm, so the clinician had to choose and to decide, and the CTC count remained blinded. So some patients were to be treated by hormone therapy, and I will refer to that subgroup as the clinical low subgroup, and some patients were treated by frontline chemotherapy and the clinical high group. In the other arm, the clinician choice was just dismissed. And we based the patient treatment only on the circulating tumor cell count, low CTC counts, which means a good prognosis, patients were treated with endocrine therapy. High CTC counts and worse prognosis, patients were treated with chemotherapy. In both the study arm, maintenance hormone therapy was allowed after frontline chemotherapy. So we were comparing head-to-head a very single biomarker, standalone biomarker versus a multi-parametric clinical estimate. And so we therefore aimed at demonstrating a non-inferiority in terms of progression-free survival between the CTC-driven arm and the clinically driven arm. So secondary endpoints included overall survival, which is very important in first-line trials, and pre-specified subgroup analysis. We randomized nearby 800 patients, and the results have been reported with a median follow-up of 30 months. So here's the primary objective of the trial. So the primary objective was met. So we are demonstrating a non-inferiority. If you are using this single biomarker, your single biomarker, your decision is not inferior to a very heterogeneous, clinically driven decision. And the median PFS was of 15.6 months in the CTC arm, 14 months in the control arm. So we also had very similar overall survival curves. And So the main point here is just to say that if you are hesitating about which drug to give, for example, in the overall study population, you're not making any mistake if you rely on the CTC count to take a decision. And then we will dive into planned subgroup analysis, which are quite interesting. And so we have basically four kind of patients. So clinical low CTC low, clinical low CTC high, clinical high CTC low, and clinical high CTC high. And you see that the characteristics highlight that the clinical low CTC low subgroup has rather the more favorable profile, whereas the patient with clinical high, so patient for which chemotherapy was the favorite treatment option for the clinician, and they also had a high CTC count, this patient have a very poor characteristics. Most patients, when treated with chemo, were treated by taxane and capecitabine, so the standard for first-line treatment. So here are the concordant groups. So the first subgroup here is about half of the patients. They were treated by hormone therapy in both arms, so there is no difference between the two curves. It was fully expected. But we do have a very good progression-free survival in this patient of 18 months. So without CDK4/6 inhibitors, single agent endocrine therapy in CTC low patient can give you a very good PFS. On the other side of the prognosis, you have these patients that are really at high risk of short PFS, and the PFS was not that bad with about 12 months achieved with chemotherapy frontline, maybe followed by endocrine therapy. So for this concordant subgroup, basically CTC count complements the prognostic estimates and may isolate patients with excellent or poor outcome. What is interesting, and the most interesting, of course, is patients with discrepant. You know, when the clinician here in that subgroup were thinking to endocrine therapy first, but this patient had also at the same time a high CTC count. So if this patient, if randomized in the control arm, were given endocrine therapy, if randomized in the CTC arm, were given chemotherapy frontline. And what we see here is that superiority for the CTC arm in terms of hazard ratio, and it was statistically significant, and we also see a trend toward statistical significance in terms of overall survival. So again, if you have a patient that is you think that endocrine therapy is appropriate for that patient, but a high CTC count, chemotherapy might achieve better results. What is also very interesting and a bit unexpected was the other subgroup, the clinical high CTC low patient. So patient for which chemotherapy was the most appropriate option, according to the clinician, but they had a low CTC count. So they were treated by chemo in the control arm, by hormone therapy in the CTC arm. And what we see here is that first, so there is no statistically significant difference between the two arms, yet if you look at the curve, you kind of see a difference, and the lack of statistical significance might be due to the limited number of patients included in that subgroup. But apparently, the chemotherapy is doing better. And to conclude, so what we did, this is an exploratory, so unplanned analysis. We took together the two discordant subgroups, and we analyzed them not by the allocated arm, but by the allocated therapy. So we compare in patients who have discrepant prognostic estimates whether it is better to treat them with endocrine therapy or frontline chemotherapy. And so we find that it is worse to treat this patient with chemotherapy, not only because you achieve a longer progression-free survival in this patient, but also you achieve a longer overall survival for this patient. And overall survival is extremely rare, and in first-line trial, I think this is a really interesting result, highlighting that basically the use of frontline chemotherapy, which has been dismissed for a long time, and it can be a very suitable option for patients with unfavorable characteristics such as high CTC count. So the conclusion was, so in the overall population, CTC count was tested as a standalone biomarker. Again, it is reproducible, and you don't need a clinician or, you know, to, is my clinician a good doctor or a bad doctor? You just do a test, and it can tell you what treatment to receive. And in the overall population, this biomarker is clinically reliable. There is room for improvement, of course, by combining CTC count and integrate it into multi-parametric decision tools. In patients with more than 5 CTC, elevated CTC count, chemotherapy is better than a single agent on the clean therapy. And now we have CDK4/6 inhibitors in first line, so it's worth to do further study with these new drugs. And if the discardum subgroup analysis I showed you, this is the first contemporary study that reports significant reduction in the risk of death. And again, this is an extremely rare result with frontline chemotherapy. So this result was obtained in about 300 patients, so it's not a small subgroup. And these patients were randomized between hormone therapy and chemo. And I think this result challenges our current standard. So to conclude, CTC count should be included in the decision algorithm. So to choose between frontline chemo or single-agent hormone therapy in hormone receptor-positive, HER2-negative metastatic breast cancer patients.
Thank you. We'll take questions. And my first question is, and you mentioned the CDK4/6 inhibitors, now, but we use them as standard of care in first-line setting, and we know that these patients have a very quick response, as quick as with chemotherapy. So how do you think your results are play into nowadays where we use CDK4/6 inhibitors?
Yes. So the first thing is that most of these patients are still alive, and so most of about 80% of these patients did receive CDK4/6 inhibitors in a more advanced setting, like in the Palomar 3 study. And so far, the use of CDK4/6 inhibitors in first line has not yet shown any superiority to its use as in a further line. So we'll see whether this first line use of CDK4/6 will stand. Of course, also the idea is that you saw that patients with low CTC counts can achieve a very long PFS with single agent or endocrine therapy. And, you know, for some people, because of financial issue or for comorbidities, we are hesitating about using CDK4/6. And this test can, like, reassure you and tell you, okay, you can go with hormone therapy as single agent at first-line therapy.
Hi, Neil Osterweil with Oncology Practice. Dr. Kakamani, would you be confident, based on these findings and using CTC, would you use it as just as a decision aid? Would it tip the balance for one therapy or another in certain patients?
I would probably want to see another study or see a little more follow-up. One of the issues is the CDK4/6 inhibitor, but it is true, CDK4/6 inhibitors, besides their cost, $10,000 a month, also are toxic to our patients. They cause neutropenias, increase infections, some diarrhea. So if there is a group that potentially I can save from taking a CDK4/6 inhibitor in the first-line setting, I'd love to do that. In the metastatic setting, what we're trying to do for years is de-escalate therapy. So the idea of giving chemotherapy instead of endocrine therapy is a little foreign to us. And in Europe, they've been doing it way longer than we have. So that's my concern, but these results are really the first results with CTCs where you're seeing survival benefit by doing CTCs. In the past, we were able to tailor our treatment based on CTCs, but there was no survival benefit. So this is the strength of this study, and we need studies like this to figure out how to use them better.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So we will move on to our third presentation, and this is by Dr. Rutgers. He's a principal investigator for AMAROS clinical trial and a surgical oncologist, which is why he's up early in the morning, at the Netherlands Cancer Institute in Amsterdam. The abstract is radiotherapy or surgery of the axilla after a positive sentinel node in breast cancer patients, 10-year follow-up results from the ERTC AMAROS trial.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Kakamani. Yes, it's a pleasure and honor to present the results, the 10-year results of the AMAROS trial. AMAROS stands for After Mapping of the Axilla Radiotherapy or Surgery. It has nothing to do with bitter, because AMAROS is in Italian, Dr. Dicenzi, means bitter, but it's a sweet trial. So you will understand this later on why I think so. So this is the AMAROS trial, and it is the most important role of mine in this trial, of me in this trial, was find out this acronym. I have no disclosures, and the background probably you all know what the sentinel node biopsy is. You know, the sentinel node is the lymph node most likely to harbor the metastasis, and these lymph nodes can be identified during surgery by using tracers, either radioactive or color tracers. And these nodes are most likely to harbor the cancer cells from the primary tumor through the lymph vessels. And the standard paradigm is if the sentinel node is clean or only containing minimal disease, there is no further axillary surgery indicated. And if there is cancer, complete axillary surgery, and this is associated with side effects, predominantly lymphedema. We had, in the 90s, done a couple of trials where we randomized between surgery and radiation therapy in patients with clinical unsuspicious lymph nodes in the axilla. It's before the sentinel node era, and there it turns out it was smaller trials that radiotherapy appears to be an equivalent to the surgery. So this this trial started in 2001, were for patients with invasive breast cancer between 5 millimeter and 5 centimeters, clinically node negative either by palpation or ultrasound, and were scheduled for breast conservation or mastectomy at any age and, of course, informed consent. These patients were randomized to either axillary clearance or radiotherapy before we did the sentinel node biopsy because, one, we want to prevent selection bias if we did it afterwards, and we had the information of sentinel node biopsy afterwards, then doctors may think, okay, this is not a patient for the trial, I want to treat them anyway. So to prevent selection bias, and secondly, to enable doctors to do an axillary clearance in the same operation for those patients who were randomized to the axillary clearance by doing a frozen section intraoperatively, and patients who were randomized, if the sentinel node was positive, to clearance, we could proceed in the same surgery. So that was the reason. This system caused some imbalance in the number of patients who had axillary clearance and radiotherapy, you will see later. So we started off with 4,800 patients, and one-third of them had a positive sentinel node, and these were randomized between axillary clearance, 744, and radiotherapy, 681, as I alluded to, this small imbalance in number of patients. In 2013, we had the first 5 years results, and there was no difference between surgery and radiotherapy. There were very few relapses in the axilla, and there was significant less lymphedema after radiotherapy. So this was the first results, but it was criticism. There were so few events that the trial was underpowered for its non-inferiority design. We needed 52 events, and by then we had 11 events. And it would take another 30 years to come to this 52 event, so we presented as it was, but it was underpowered. But it was clinically very nice for the patients, of course, because there were very few events. The other one was the follow-up is too short, 5 years, and we have to see a longer follow-up. So in itself, results were not universally accepted, not in every country. So now we have the 10-year analysis. And the patient populations we analyzed were those with a positive sentinel node. And the median follow-up is now 10 years, and the cutoff date was as of February 2018. Regarding the side effects, we have an update of 5 years because we had much more forms at 5 years, and we don't have forms at 10 years because that was considered too expensive to get all these patients the forms at 10 years. So we have a 5-year follow-up on lymphedema. The baseline, the age was 56 in both groups, well-balanced, and the grading was well-balanced and as expected, small tumor, 70 millimeter, and 60% of women had a preoperative ultrasound of the axilla, 40% had only clinical palpation. The vast majority underwent breast conservation because they would have radiotherapy anyway. A small proportion had a mastectomy, and over 90% had any systemic treatment because of the positive sentinel node, either chemotherapy, hormonal therapy, or the combination. And the radiotherapy to the breast and chest wall was well distributed between the two groups. The number of sentinel nodes was also equal in two groups, about two. And the size of the metastasis in the sentinel node was in two-thirds of patients was a so-called macrometastasis, and in one-third minor metastasis. The median number of nodes in those patients who had an axillary clearance was 15. And more interesting, in those lymph nodes in patients who had an axillary clearance, next to the positive sentinel node was one-third, so 33% had more positive nodes in the axilla in those patients who had an axillary clearance. And one expect, of course, the same proportion of node positivity in those patients who had radiation therapy to the axilla. So one could imagine that one-third of the patients who had radiation to the axilla also had positive nodes at primary treatment. These are the 10 years results. Nothing happens. So at 5 years, in the axillary clearance group, four patients out of 744 had an axillary first event, and now it's seven. And the radiotherapy group, it's seven patients, and now it's 11. And you can imagine this is not significant difference, and it is, again, extremely low reoccurrence of lymph node metastasis in this group. And, of course, it has no effect on disease-free and overall survival, as you may expect. What we've encountered, that there was a small excess of second primaries in the patients who had axillary radiotherapy. And this is, to some extent, in the contralateral breast cancers and on other sites, but in itself, the absolute numbers were very low. We cannot exclude an effect of the radiation therapy to the axilla, but we have to realize that 85% of these patients received radiation therapy anyway because of the breast conservation. So it is for us difficult to see whether the addition of the axillary radiation field would lead to more second primaries. The side effects, 5 years, and particularly the lymphedema, and we have clinical observation, we have measurement of lymphedema, and we have the observation of treatment. And as you can see, the occurrence of lymphedema in the radiation group was half of that in patients who had surgery, and this maintains over the years. As the 5 years, 20% of patients who had axillary surgery had signs of lymphedema and treatment of lymphedema, as compared to 14% in patients who had radiation therapy. In the clinical observation, it's the same figures. And treatment is an even larger difference, but in general, patients who get surgery, in general, get initially already more treatment than patients who had radiation therapy. In general, in surgical practice, patients who had an axillary clearance are sent to the physiotherapist for prevention of lymphedema. So in conclusion, both axillary clearance and radiotherapy provide excellent and comparable local regional controls. Patients have a positive sentinel node in the axilla after 10 years. There's significantly less lymphedema after radiation therapy for 5 years, and therefore this can be considered as a standard procedure. And of course, I'm very grateful to the patients and all the co-workers in many hospitals. Thank you.
Now, my question. So, you know, this is now two trials, Z11 and Amarose, although
yeah.
They are different.
Three.
You're right. Showing that there really we shouldn't worry too much about clearing the axilla and doing axillary node dissections. What do you do in your practice?
We mix up the results of the Z11 and the Amarose. That is, if it's limited load involvement and early breast cancer, and of course that's subjective, but we have some cutoffs for that, we do nothing. Is the sentinel node positive? If it's larger tumors, high-grade LVI, lymphovascular invasion, and there is two positive sentinel nodes, then we irradiate the axilla according to the Amarose trial. So we take both on board for the clinical management. And this is a discussion within our tumor board, of course, in the multidisciplinary team, and together with the patient. In itself, side effects of radiation therapy is really limited.
So in patients that don't have clinically positive lymph nodes, you usually don't do an axillary node dissection anymore.
At all, no. It's interesting to see the proportion of women who underwent axillary clearance for their breast cancer treatment in the Netherlands Cancer Institute over the past 20 years. 20 years ago, it was 80%. Nowadays, it's 3%. That's what it is. 3. Oh, I'm so sorry. Though this, in our institute, we have looked at the proportion of women who got an axillary clearance in the treatment of their breast cancer, and 20 years ago it was 75 or 80%, and now it's 3%. Because of the sentinel node, because of the radiation therapy, because of the neoadjuvant chemotherapy. So in our institute, an axillary clearance is a rare operation for our residents. They have to go to the melanoma doctors to learn their axillary clearance. In breast cancer, it's really rare in our environment. Oh, yeah, and I didn't say that the occurrence of lymph node metastasis remains totally the same, 1% a year. It doesn't change at all.
And this is really the beauty of this this sort of de-escalation in therapy, where you're improving the morbidity of our patients. Our patients have a better quality of life because they don't have as much lymphedema without compromising their outcomes. The chance of them having a local recurrence is very low. So taking 20 and 30 and sometimes 40 lymph nodes out that we used to do, we don't need to do anymore. We would radiate the appropriate patients. And again, their local recurrence rate is very, very low.
Nick Mulcahy, Medscape. Dr. Kakamani, if you were to write the conclusion to this study for the publication, well, what would the two or three sentences be?
Not being a surgeon, I'll still venture to do this. To me, it's the fact that you are avoiding axillary dissections. You're decreasing the risk of lymphedema, and at the same time, you're not compromising the outcomes of the patients. The patients are still going to live the same and will have a very low risk of recurrence. You have to find the right patients. If you have a patient that comes in and has a bulky lymph node, and that's not a patient that was included in any of these studies. But the majority of patients that we see with breast cancer have these small metastases to their axillas, if they do. And in those cases, doing radiation instead of doing more surgery or not doing anything is very appropriate.
Okay, and then one last question, if I may. What's current practice in the United States? What are people doing, out at various centers?
And I actually would like to get the European approach as well. And I'll talk about my experience. It's been very slow in changing our standard, which has been axillary node dissection. And it's longer follow-ups from Z11, from Amarose, that are helping our surgeons cut back on the amount of surgery that they're doing. So I've been surprised because, these results are, we've had these trials out for 10 years, and we still are doing more axillary node dissections than we should be doing. But I'd like to get everybody else's opinion and also get the European approach.
Yeah, well, in Europe, there is also differences. For instance, in the UK, the trial is repeated to some extent. In our country, we adapted quite swiftly this principle.
Mm-hmm.
In Germany as well, there is difference throughout, and because of the criticism I started off with. As I learned in Asia, it's gradually more and more accepted as an indication, and I would like to ask Frank, Dr. Piccini, what's his opinion, because you have some more broader idea
right,
in the U.S.
As she pointed out, the results have been out for quite some time, but it's been a very slow adoption.
Are we talking about the Z11 results?
Yeah,
both.
And
Amarose and
okay. Z11, both of them. And it's been a kind of a slow adoption. I'm from the Midwest. It's been very slow. Slowly seeing the amount of axillary dissections going down and down through the years. I'm sorry. Slowly seeing the axillary dissection rates going down. It's been very slow.
Taking off a toy of a surgeon is a difficult thing to do.
Taking what?
A toy of a surgeon.
A toy away from the surgeon. And believe me, it's the same thing with medical oncologists and chemotherapy.
They're just used to doing it for so long.
Thank you so much, Dr. Rickens. So we're going to conclude with our fourth presentation. Dr. Bacini will give it. He's a principal investigator and at the MPH Radiation Oncology Institute, 21st Century Oncology in Pontiac, Michigan. The abstract is primary results from the NSABP B39, a randomized phase 3 trial on conventional whole breast radiation versus partial breast radiation for women with stage 0, 1, and 2 breast cancer.
Thank you. I'll be presenting the results of NSABP B39 RTOG0413 on behalf of the NRG Oncology Group. I don't have the disclosure slide, but I don't have any relevant financial disclosures. Just as a little bit of a background, standard breast-conserving therapy consists of lumpectomy plus about 5 to 7 weeks of whole breast irradiation. That was the standard for the past 50 years or so. In an effort to improve the quality of life of our patients, we studied whether or not we could reduce the overall treatment time significantly in these patients down to a week or less by doing a technique referred to as partial breast irradiation, meaning limiting the radiation only to the lymphatic cavity region and accelerating the treatment down to five days or less. So that's how this protocol was developed. We randomized, I don't have the number here, but 4,216 women to either whole breast irradiation, the standard of care at that time, 5 to 6 weeks of radiation therapy, or partial breast irradiation using one of three techniques that were in use at that time and still are in use today, meaning either 3D conformal external beam radiation therapy completed in 5 days, or interstitial brachytherapy, again completed in 5 days, or device-based brachytherapy. This was a diverse group of patients, as you'll see in a moment, but we randomized these patients based upon their disease stage, stratified these patients based upon their disease stage, their menopausal status, their hormone receptor status, and their intention to receive chemotherapy. The endpoints of the study, of course, the primary endpoint was to determine whether or not partial breast irradiation controlled the tumor in the breast, in other words, the ipsilateral breast tumor recurrence rate was the same as whole breast irradiation, but the secondary endpoints were also distant disease-free interval, recurrence-free interval, which I'll define in a moment, and overall survival. Getting directly into the results of the study, this was equivalence test for protocol-defined margin. For us to declare that partial breast irradiation and whole breast irradiation were equivalent regarding the ipsilateral breast tumor recurrence risk, the 90% confidence interval for the observed hazard ratio had to lie entirely between 0.667 and 1.5. I'll show you that diagram in a moment. So we observed 161 recurrences, ipsilateral breast tumor recurrences, as first events. There were 90 in the partial breast irradiation arm and 71 in the whole breast irradiation arm. The hazard ratio was 1.22 and the confidence interval was 0.94. 1.58. Partial breast irradiation did not meet the criteria for equivalence to whole breast irradiation based upon the upper limit of the hazard ratio confidence interval. We wanted to lie between 0.667 and 1.5. However, the absolute difference in the 10-year cumulative incidence of IBTR between partial and whole breast irradiation was 0.7%. So this slide just shows for you diagrams for you, the upper limit of the confidence interval we wanted to be 1.5, and it was 1.58. This is the 10-year cumulative incidence of ipsilateral breast tumor recurrence between partial breast irradiation patients and whole breast irradiation. The absolute difference was 0.7%. As a secondary endpoint, we also looked at the recurrence-free interval, which was defined as the time from randomization to the development of a first event, either a local, regional, or distant recurrence, regardless of any intervening contralateral or second breast cancer. At 10 years, the recurrence-free interval for whole breast irradiation patients was 93.4%, and for partial breast irradiation was 91.8%, a difference of 1.6%, but this was statistically significant. We did not see any statistically significant differences, however, in distant disease-free interval, in overall survival, and in disease-free survival. So basically, the intent to treat and as treated analysis did not refute the hypothesis that PBI is inferior and could not declare that whole breast radiation and partial breast radiation were equivalent in controlling local and breast tumor recurrence. However, as I pointed out, the absolute difference between the techniques at 10 years was 0.7%. The risk of a relapse-free interval was statistically significantly higher, again, for partial breast compared to whole breast. But again, this difference, absolute difference at 10 years, was also small, 1.6%. Interesting, the breast cancer event rates at a median follow-up of 10.2 years in this population were overall very good and quite low. The IBTR rate was about 4 to 5%, as you've seen. The distant metastasis rate was around 3%. And the overall breast cancer death rate was about 2%. As I mentioned earlier, the distant disease-free interval, overall survival, and disease-free survival were not statistically significant between the two arms of the study. I didn't show the data, but grade 3 to 5 toxicities were low, as well as the rate of second cancers, and they were not different between the two arms. We are performing additional analyses currently to evaluate the secondary endpoints, of course, of quality of life and cosmesis. Because the differences relative to both lateral breast tumor recurrence and relapse-free interval were very small, PBI may be an acceptable alternative to whole breast radiation for a proportion of women who are undergoing breast-conserving surgery. Thank you.
And we'll take some questions. So based on the results of this trial, what would you do in your practice?
Well, we are offering partial breast irradiation to our patients. There are a lot of competing ways to do radiation now, as I'm sure you know. Probably the biggest competing way is to do 3 weeks of whole breast irradiation. So for those patients who have transportation issues, the more elderly patients, we try to offer partial breast irradiation within the guidelines of ASTRO and that are out there right now. I mean, this has been, you know, this trial is over 15 years old now, and a lot of these techniques have been refined, but we are offering partial breast radiation to our patients. It's nice to see, though, that this was the largest trial ever looking at partial breast, a very diverse group of patients. Even though we weren't able to prove equivalence, demonstrate equivalence, it's nice to see that even in this large population of patients, this extended follow-up, the differences are quite small.
So, Marie DeWise, breastcancer.org. So, a little bit earlier this week, we had the whole session on partial breast radiation,
right.
And they show the ASTRO guidelines at the end.
Right.
And, you know, 2 centimeters or less, non-lobular, women
right.
50 and older, no LVI, clear margins, all that stuff, no nodes involved. But this study had some of those women in there, right?
Right.
Women of any age, it could be up to 3 centimeters, right? You could have lymph nodes involved
correct.
Up to three
yeah.
nodes. So were there enough events in this study to shed light on the role of partial breast radiation in those subpopulations that we
right.
don't know very much about?
Yeah, we tried to do those exploratory analyses to look at whether or not certain patients were better treated with whole breast radiation or not, and we weren't able to really pick out any group of patients that had a better or worse outcome based upon all those criteria. We've yet to look at the quality indices for radiation therapy. In other words, how much of the breast actually needs to be treated. And that's a subsequent publication. But at the present time, I would just suggest sticking with the ASTRO guidelines.
But one thing I think, one take home, which is sort of offbeat on this, mm-hmm. is that it's given that partial breast radiation does perform well, maybe not quite as well, may make it people feel a bit more comfortable, let's
exactly.
say, providing heart shielding at the end where you might miss some breast tissue in order to spare the heart. So this might be, reassurance that you can protect long-term toxicity to the heart while, you know, missing a little bit of the breast.
Absolutely. I mean, you are limiting the radiation to other normal tissues. That's one advantage of this
right.
technique. But I think the take-home message also, there are limitations as to how far back you can do the radiation therapy. In other words,
right.
how much you can limit to the lumpectomy cavity region. There's still, radiation is still important, I think is the take-home
right.
message.
And, it's also important to note this is a selected group of people. I mean,
right.
this is a favorable group. It's not
correct.
Like we can extrapolate.
I mean, we did have a more diverse population, as you pointed out, node positive, you know, some are higher grade, but at the end of the day, still stick with, I think, the better risk patients, lower
mm-hmm.
risk patients.
Thank you.
Pam Harrison, Medscape. I'm just wondering about the endpoints with disease, distance disease-free interval, overall survival, disease-free survival. I mean, they're not different between the two arms. Aren't those the more important endpoints?
I think at the end of the day, they're most important endpoints, but certainly a recurrence is still an important event for a patient, and so our goal is always to limit that as much as possible. But you're absolutely correct. I mean, putting it into perspective, does a 0.7% higher risk of recurrence, how does that offset when you know the survival rates are the same? I think that's what patients and doctors need to take into consideration. This is a pretty dramatic difference in treatment, right? 6 weeks down to 1 week or less. And, you know, we've seen, there have been many studies looking at quality of life, and as you can imagine, the quality of life is better. Pretty intuitive.
Yeah. Well, you also said that this is like almost 15 years old, this trial.
Right.
And with the newer radiation
approaches,
I would suspect that those tiny little differences in recurrence might not even exist anymore.
Well, that's my own bias, but then again, the study didn't show that, but, you know, that's my bias. The techniques right now are trying to deliver the radiation in probably two or three treatments overall.
Yeah.
Whether that
Well, that's the whole trend in radiation therapy, is it not?
Well, I think it's the trend in all oncology, right?
Okay.
The less is better as long as the control rates are the same.
Okay, thank you.
And I think to this point, it's important, I think, when we design the trials to look at clinically meaningful differences.
Correct.
Because we all want, we don't want to harm our patients.
Right.
But at the same time, we are also harming them by giving them more treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're designing a trial where a 0.7% difference is statistically significant, you know, is that, you know, we probably would have been able to get away with much fewer patients, right? And, you know, and the difference of 1.5%, 2% not being significant, then I think everybody would have been happy with that.
Well, I think the question was, it was such a controversial topic, you know, 10, 15 years ago. I think we have to give credit to the legacy groups, NSABP, RTOG, for putting this trial together. It was tough, as you can imagine, but, you know, putting the science together wasn't easy. But they did it, and 10 years later, here we are, and I think it's a very important study. So, certainly important to women.
Yes. Well, thank you.
Dr. Kakumani, may I add to this and echo Eric Weiner's idea that if there is an expected very small difference in outcome between two strategies in breast cancer treatment, and the number of events are extremely low, like in the MROs, like here, do we need randomized trials, or can we do with prospective registration trials with preset thresholds where we can do it with 800 or 1,200 patients? And I really would like to see more acceptance of that idea, because we can advance de-escalation much, much faster as compared to these enormous enterprises, 4,000 women. That's my position. Maybe you can comment on that.
I agree. Well, thank you all for being here today.
Yes, thank you. And this concludes our press conference for today. We'll see you back here tomorrow at 7:30. I want to thank Dr. Kakumani for moderating today and also to our presenters.